Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. The global COVID-19 pandemic has provided new openings to link global health with climate action. This will influence the upcoming meetings on global climate change called COP26. Contributing host Doug Becker explores with Shannon Gibson of the University of Southern California.
On December 12, 2015, the nations of the world agreed to the Paris Climate Accord. These are intended to slow the rate of climate change. Since this historic date, the U.S. announced its intention to withdraw, and the pandemic has had a profound impact on the agreement. On today's show, we discuss both the effects of the American withdrawal and the effects of the pandemic on future agreements on the Paris Climate Accords. My guest is Shannon Gibson. She is Associate Professor of Political Science, International Relations, and Environmental Studies at the University of Southern California. She is the author of the upcoming book, Politics of the Global Environment, that's due in spring of 2021. Shannon, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. First, can we start with a discussion of what the Paris Climate Accords are and what they're intended to try to address in the way they approach?
Sure. So the Paris Climate Accords are basically the second major international treaty that we have to deal with climate change at this point. Preceding the Paris Climate Accords, we had the Kyoto Protocol, which originated in the 1990s. Only ran for a very short time period, had about a five-year commitment time period with very mixed record. It only applied to developed countries in terms of which countries were required to reduce their emissions. Developing countries got a little bit of sort of a time lag in terms of when they were supposed to join on board. And so what we see is that among those developed countries, some countries met their targets, some did not. But at the end of the day, global emissions continued to rise. So in terms of the end goal of the treaty, it was not successful. So recognizing that, countries early on in the sort of early 2000s realized that we needed a successor treaty when the Kyoto Protocol expired in 2012. And so as part of that, they began negotiating a successor treaty, which was supposed to have arrived in 2009 in Copenhagen. That is the first time I went to the climate talks. And famously, those talks fell apart quite tragically and played out for the media. And so that's how we ended up with the Paris agreements, is that a new timeline was set or a new deadline was set for 2015. So at that time in 2015, it's been noted as a very historic agreement because we did get international consensus. This treaty does apply to developed and developing countries, with the main goal of reducing what we call historical temperatures to 2 degrees Celsius, or keeping them at that level with an ambition of a 1.5 degree target. And so coming up here with COP26 is going to be the first time for us to sort of verify what did countries commit to and have they met their targets that they established for themselves.
What exactly is a COP meeting?
So COP stands for the Conference of Parties. And so COP26 means that this is, sadly, the 26th year we have been negotiating on climate change. And with not too much to show for it in terms of reducing global emissions. And so what the COP means is basically it's the meeting of all the parties to the Convention on Climate Change, which is sort of the umbrella negotiating entity that the Kyoto Protocol and the Paris Agreement fall under.
So in essence, the COP meetings are the countries that have agreed to the legal instrument, agreed to deal with climate change, getting together to try to strengthen the agreements, monitor compliance with the agreement, possibly suggest future agreements. Is that fair to say?
Yes, exactly. And so, for example, being a member of the COP, it's very inclusive. For example, the Holy See is a signatory and an observer member for that. And the United States, even if we leave the Paris Agreement, we will still be part of the COP because we are still a signatory of the Framework Convention on Climate Change.
Right. And that dates back to 1992 in the Rio Conference.
That's correct.
Okay. So how often do these COP meetings meet?
So they're annual. When you look at all the different environmental regimes, we're one of the few. So for example, when it comes to endangered species, they meet every 3 years, biodiversity is every two. Climate change is annual. And they usually always happen in November and December of each year, except for this year, where obviously our time schedule has changed as a result of the coronavirus outbreak.
So there's two major developments I wanted to talk about, but since you mentioned the coronavirus outbreak, and of course, it's on all of our minds at this point, you being shut in as a result of this. What have been some of the effects on climate negotiations that this global pandemic, you know, have had?
Well, I think from my perspective, just to provide a little background, when I attend the climate negotiations, I attend as an observer with an environmental NGO, a non-governmental organization. So I kind of come at it from a different perspective, more so the civil society perspective than, say, serving on a state delegation. And I can say for civil society, this has presented a number of changes. For decades now, NGOs, civil society groups, and developing countries have been trying to make this point or this connection between human health and climate change and have not done so very successfully. Instead, the arguments that tend to make more sense or to gain more traction have to do with the economics of climate change, maybe the winners or losers of climate change. But the health rhetoric really just has not gained traction. That's changing right now. There is a big focus on air pollution, particulate matter pollution, and how that has direct correlations with COVID-19 mortality. We're also seeing, again, parallels with regards to climate change and the coronavirus and what a lot of the civil society groups are saying, that these are both basically symptoms of the same broken system, right? That these are a result of broken political and economic systems. So I think what's interesting is that in the framing of this is that we're getting more emphasis on these human health aspects, but also this joining of these two issues, which maybe gives a little bit more emphasis or urgency to dealing with climate change, because like global public health and infectious diseases, it's something that we continually put off and think it's never going to happen. And COVID-19 shows us it's going to happen.
You're seeing this linkage, the linkage largely coming from civil society groups. Are we also seeing state actors starting to draw this linkage a little bit more closely?
Oh, yes, especially in terms of when you think about vulnerabilities. The Global South has been particularly vocal about this. And they've been doing this, and they've been trying to make this point for a while. If you look back at, for example, outbreaks relating to malaria, West Nile, other what we call sort of zoonotic or vector-borne diseases like those coming from mosquitoes, there's always been this strong argument that ecological changes in patterns, whether it be droughts, floods, an ENSO cycle, something like that, those have direct correlations with the transmission of vector-borne diseases like dengue, leishmaniasis, etc. So they've been trying to make that point for so long, but for some reason developed countries, perhaps because the developed countries don't experience those tropical type diseases as much, have not given it much credence. But I think now that rhetoric is so much stronger when we see an outbreak or a pandemic that is truly global in nature. And there are some ties here with this likely being a zoonotic disease, and something that has emerged as a result of interference with ecological or ecosystems.
Are there specific leaders in making these sorts of connections? Are there certain states that have been particularly vocal about this, or certain non-governmental organizations that have been particularly vocal?
It hasn't been so much states that I've noticed yet, just because it seems as though all the states are solely focused on the coronavirus. So they're sort of pushing off their negotiations. But civil society, I mean, when you look at the entire spectrum of the environmental movement, from the large transnational NGOs like Greenpeace, Friends of the Earth, 350.org, Conservation International, to the more radical groups like Extinction Rebellion, the Sunrise Movement, they're the ones that are really pushing this rhetoric. And my experience in negotiations is that oftentimes it's this sort of pattern that we call diagonalism, where civil society and developing countries will eventually sync up in their framing and their rhetoric. Sometimes developing countries lead, sometimes civil society does, but I would not be surprised in COP26 to see a very strong alliance among civil society, and particularly G77 or developing countries, being really vocal about this in these upcoming negotiations.
Interesting. When is COP26 and where is it scheduled?
So it was originally supposed to be in November of this year, and now they have delayed it to an undetermined date, likely in mid-2021. It was supposed to have been held in Glasgow, Scotland, hosted by the United Kingdom. However, we don't know the date. We also don't know the format. Is it going to be held as a physical negotiation, or is it going to be a virtual negotiation? One challenge with the physical aspect logistically is that both the conference center in Glasgow and its backup location in London have become field hospitals. So there's a big concern about, is there even going to be the infrastructure available? Will they have time to get those facilities, if they're free and clear, to even get them ready? And then that brings up the idea of a virtual negotiation, which has both pros and cons associated with that format.
I want to get into the pros and cons in a moment, but I find the fact that Glasgow and the UK would be the host fascinating, because my understanding is the UK has actually become a bit more vocal about climate change, in part as an island nation. I know there's a coalition of island nations that have been particularly vocal about the need for action. Is it fair to say that the UK is joining that coalition, or is that a bit of an overstatement with respect to the UK's commitment to climate action?
The UK is a hard one to peg down right now, to be honest, because on the one hand, when they were a part of the EU, they were a leader in terms of taking on climate in terms of what we call burden sharing. So when the EU signed on to the Kyoto Protocol and then later the Paris Agreement, they did it as a regional bloc. And then within that regional bloc, they split up the mitigation targets based on the capability of each country and the historical responsibility in terms of who contributed the most to climate change. And so the UK typically took one of the largest reduction targets. Now with Brexit, that all has to be renegotiated. What's interesting is that Boris Johnson has kind of indicated dual positions. On the one hand, he's a friend of President Trump, it seems, in some cases, and does like to foster this idea of free trade and opening up economies and things that sometimes work against lowering one's emissions. But also still wants to be a leader in some of these normative issues like climate change outside of the EU. So there's been a little bit of mixed messaging in terms of what we can expect from them at the negotiations.
You're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. We're discussing the future of the Paris Climate Accords after the US withdrawal and the global pandemic with Shannon Gibson of the University of Southern California. So Professor Gibson, on the next question, you had mentioned there's pros and cons to the idea of a virtual meeting. I mean, I can think of one obvious pro, which is no air travel, and so therefore not contributing. But tell me a bit more about what these pros and cons are.
And that's one thing. It is one of sort of the great hypocrisies of these mega conferences, is that scholars, activists, delegates travel hundreds, thousands of miles yearly in order to engage in mitigation talks. So there is that one thing, is that this will obviously, if it were online, it would lower the carbon footprint of having these major events. On the pro side, additionally, some have said that this could be sort of like the great equalizer. Typically in the United Nations, we kind of hear this ideal of it being one state, one vote, all countries have the same footing, which is different than, say, organizations like the World Bank or the IMF, where countries get votes based on, you know, how much money they contribute to the fund. But in reality, at these negotiations, power does matter. I can tell you, when I attended the first talks that I went to in Copenhagen, I was shocked to see the first day when the US delegation walked in with 300 members. And then small developing countries come in with 8 people, 12 people. The Maldives has, you know, a group of 20, right? So these power politics still play out. And so one argument is that if this is online, then you don't have countries being restricted by necessarily finances, economics, capacity, expertise, things like that. On the flip side of that, though, there are others that are concerned that if it goes online, it creates a potential for less transparency, that more deals will be worked out in. Normally, it happens in the halls and the bars around the climate talks. Now, the concerns is that there will be sort of like sidebar Zoom rooms, right? That there will be more closed door talks, that there will be exclusion of stakeholders like civil society, indigenous peoples organizations, groups of that nature. And then finally, we have to take into account the digital divide, right? So even though theoretically as many people as possible could attend per group or per state, we do have issues with hardware, software, Wi-Fi capacity, and what will be the challenges if people simply aren't able to connect? How do they work around that?
And I can tell you that what you just described about the size of delegations, tied to that might be the level of expertise of each person who's there, or even just a physical show, is something that's fairly common in kind of all UN meetings. That's not unique to environmental negotiations. It's kind of a feature of negotiations throughout the UN system.
Exactly.
So now the US announced its intention to withdraw from the Paris Climate Accords. I always find it interesting that the accords themselves had built in that withdrawal cannot take place until, was it November 4th, 2020, or the day after the election? Mm-hmm. And I always like to remind people, my students, that was negotiated before we had any idea who the candidates were going to be, including the current president, who actually had not even declared his candidacy by that point. But with that in mind, the U.S. cannot withdraw after the election. So I guess two questions. First, what are the effects of the announcement of the withdrawal? And then second, I'll let you know what the question is going to be, which is how important is this election specifically to this COP meeting, considering that no matter how the election turns out, the current president is going to be president the day after the election. But the first question about the effects of the U.S. announcement of the withdrawal on this meeting itself.
Yeah, so the timing of the meeting with our U.S. political system created sort of a weird conundrum and almost like a lame duck position for the United States in the talks if they were to have been in November. And so you mentioned before that we have that this was written into the treaty. And so basically what's written into the treaty is similar to like when people file for divorce, they have a cooling off period, right? So you file for divorce, you have to wait a couple months before it becomes official. That's what they do with withdrawals in climate or in UN treaties in a lot of cases, that you notify the UN through a communique, and then you have a 1 year limit or 1 year waiting period until it becomes official. And so for us, based on when we signed the treaty, when we notified the UN, that day happens to be the day after our next presidential election. So had the talks been in November, basically the U.S. would have been removed from the Paris Accords no matter what, regardless of who wins the presidential election. Mm-hmm. We will be removed from the Paris Agreement. So what that meant was that if it were to happen in November, we would not be a part of the Paris Agreement and you would have a Trump delegation going to the climate talks. My experience at COP23 in Bonn, which was the first Trump delegation to attend the climate talks, is that looks a little bit like sending lower level delegates, not sort of the heavy hitters within your EPA or other agencies, and hosting side events that tout clean coal and fracking. Okay. Mm-hmm. That's what we would have seen. Now with it being moved to mid-2021, it's a game changer. Because if we get a Democratic president that is inaugurated early next year, on the day of their inauguration, by executive order, we can rejoin the Paris Agreement. Because of the nature and the structure of the treaty, it doesn't require Senate approval. So we could rejoin. And then in mid 2021, if we have a climate-friendly administration, we could re-enter the treaty with full force and start putting pressure on other countries to pick up their slack as well.
So the fact that the COP meeting was pushed beyond, first of all, how much does that raise this issue potentially in the American election? And how important is climate change going to be in the American election, and how important is the election to the success of the COP agreement, you know, or to the top companies to come to an agreement?
I think in a non-coronavirus world, it would have. I think we see that coronavirus is like the political vacuum of all time, right? It's the one thing that we did see this prior to the outbreak. When you looked at the Democratic debates during the primaries, climate change, I mean, it wasn't mentioned as much as I would think that it should be, but it was mentioned way more than it ever has been before. Right. And so especially with this new momentum or what was the momentum behind the Green New Deal, I think it has been raised in the consciousness of the two-party system in the United States. The other thing I'll say, though, is that globally, even with the U.S. withdrawing, Paris didn't burn down. Right. The treaty still continued. Countries did not leave. China stayed in. India stayed in. The EU stayed in. So I think that, you know, I fear that climate change won't be on the presidential debate topics as much as it should be because of coronavirus. But once we get to COP26, I think the world will be happy to welcome the U.S. back. But if we're not back, they're going to keep negotiating and implementing without us.
Now, one of the key elements of the Paris Accords versus Kyoto is Kyoto had hard targets, measured targets, but only bound the wealthy countries, only bound the developed countries, or what was referred to as the Annex One countries. Mm-hmm. Paris has every country, but in exchange for that, the countries themselves get to choose their targets, or, you know, get to choose their national commitments. First, have those commitments been pretty aggressive? And second, have countries been meeting their commitments?
So under Kyoto, we had more of this sort of top-down system where the UN established the goal, and then countries sort of argued back and forth to take what commitments were required to meet that ultimate goal. Paris is the opposite. It's more of a bottom-up approach. So every country creates what are called nationally determined contributions, or NDCs, in climate lingo. And so what that means is they set their own baselines. They determine which industries are included and not included. They write the rules for carbon trading, offsetting, targets, however they see fit. Which, again, on one hand is good because it did get more countries on board having that flexibility. That's why we have such international and universal participation outside of the United States. On the other hand, with no really sort of like goal mandated from the top, and countries being able to do what they want or they feel is most politically or economically feasible for them, we have fallen short of the ultimate targets. So the bare minimum target established in the Paris Agreement is that 2-degree threshold or tipping point that's been identified by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, or the IPCC. There are a number of different organizations that have looked at this. If you try and add up the contributions of all the different countries, which, by the way, is very difficult because they all get to write their own terms and use their own metrics. So they're quite difficult to compare. One group that's done particularly good job of this is the Climate Action Tracker. Mm-hmm. And they've estimated that if you add up all of the Paris pledges, that still takes us to about a 2.8 degree world. Mm-hmm. If you look at the actual policies in place, it takes us more to about a 3 or a 3.2 degree world. So in terms of, you know, we can look at compliance, which is relatively high, but when we look at effectiveness of meeting our end goal of reducing global emissions, we're still very far off.
That was what the Climate Action Tracker, is that something that people can follow on their own? Is that a tool that's online?
Yes, it's a tool online. They rank the different countries. They haven't ranked all of them. Again, it's really difficult to compare all these different NDCs, but they have a ranking of countries in terms of who are sort of the role models to those who are really not meeting the ambitions that they could. And they've also started tracking those who have made their new commitments for COP26. Because one of the big things about COP26 is that it's 5 years since the Paris Agreement, and the next major step is to ratchet up, is the terminology they use. It's time for countries to recommit in an even more progressive manner. And so they're also tracking who has ratcheted up their NDCs, and also the countries that haven't.
Sort of last question, are you optimistic that there's going to be new commitments coming out of COP26 and kind of a newfound you know, commitment to climate action, in particular considering the global recession that's been triggered by this pandemic?
I'm always one to lean towards optimism. I would like to think, even though it might be hard to feel this way in the context of American media, but I would like to think that coming out of the coronavirus or starting to emerge and to kind of rebuild and to restructure, that we will have sort of this more, a larger sense of sort of humanity and of multilateralism moving forward. Because when you look at coronavirus, no matter what, unilateralism is not going to get us a vaccine. It's not going to solve this problem for us collectively. And I think that same logic can be and needs to be applied to climate change. And so I'm hoping that perhaps as we start to see multilateralism work in response to the coronavirus, that will then bleed over into COP26. I also have great optimism when it comes to the role of civil society to be inventive and creative and to speak their voice no matter what circumstances they're confronted with. Mm. We saw this in COP21 after Paris had been the victim of a number of terrorist attacks and all permits for protests and things like that were revoked and civil society wasn't really able to be out in the streets. And they were creative in doing online protests, virtual strikes, geolocation events. So I think that civil society, along with developing countries, will still make their voices heard in COP26 and continue to urge developed countries to ratchet up their commitments.
Perfect. Well, if listeners want to follow you as you prepare for this, I know you're pretty active on Twitter and in social media. How can they follow you?
Yes, you can follow me on Twitter at Prof, so P-R-O-F-S-M Gibson. And I post lots of updates with regards to COP26. Also, in regards to the other classes I teach on global public health, COVID-19, climate justice, indigenous issues. So please follow along if you want to see what's happening at the end of this year and next.
Thank you very much, Shannon Gibson. You've listened to Scholar Circle. Our guest has been Shannon Gibson of the University of Southern California. She is Associate Professor of International Relations, Political Science, and Environmental Studies, and is the author of the forthcoming Politics of the Global Environment, which is due for publication in spring of 2021. Thank you very much.
Thank you.